May it please the court?
Yes.
My name is Hollis Whitson. I represent Christine Sparrows. Ms. Sparrows is not here today. She's serving an effective life sentence for the charges that arose in this case. And we requested oral argument in order to bring issues related to Roman numeral 1 to the court's attention. There's really two of them in there: the counsel of choice issue and the trial court's failure to adequately respond when Ms. Sparrows expressed dissatisfaction with her appointed counsel. And I'd like to start with the counsel of choice issue. And in looking over the briefs and trying to boil this all down over the weekend, it occurred to me that we've really got three questions here. We've really got the question whether or not this issue is preserved, which is encompasses the question of what was Ms. Sparrow supposed to do after September 22, 2005, the pretrial hearing. The second issue is whether the court, if it, assuming that the issue is preserved, whether it was an abuse of discretion, whether the judge was wrong in denying her right to retain counsel. And then I wasn't sure it was worthy of discussion, but the third question was really, did she even have the right? Because whether she had paid for Mr. Joseph St. Belcher or not. But to the extent that's an issue, that would be the third question. Is it preserved? Was it an abuse of discretion? And was she even entitled to retain counsel? The failure to inquire issue is really separate, and that arises under a slightly different context, and that has to do with the court's response. But let me begin with the first question in counsel of choice. I firmly believe that the issue is preserved. It was brought up numerous times, but the key time for our purposes today, I think, is September 22nd at the motions hearing. The judge considered the request. Ms. Sparrows wanted to bring her own attorney in, Joseph St. Belcher, who had represented her and her business in numerous other cases.
Excuse me, did Mr. St. Belcher ever appear in the trial court?
If you mean a formal entry of appearance under, for example, Rule 44, no.
He
was there, yes.
Attended?
Yes, he was even there for portions of the trial. But it's not a matter of record. There's no citation. Nobody turned around and said, hey, Joe's here. But this is what I've been told. So when the court denied it, it was very explicit. You know, most courts, and I would have a much harder challenge before you today had the court done what, for example, the U.S. Supreme Court and Gonzalez said courts may do. If the court had said, well, Ms. Sparrows, that's well and good, do what you will, but I'm not continuing the motion hearing, do what you will, but I'm not continuing trial, it's set for 5 months from now, of course you may bring your own attorney, but I'm not changing my schedule, that would have been one case. But that's not the case we're here on. And ignore, as the people may in their briefs, the fact that he denied this request. He did. In fact, the answer brief, on page 5 of the answer brief, they quote all the reasons. The judge, there was no question that he had denied her the right to bring counsel. The public defender said, well, she's not indigent anymore, and she can't even have us. And he said, no, I have discretion to tell you, you are on the case. There won't be another lawyer coming. He said the judge apparently didn't believe that Mr. St. Belcher, or I guess anyone else, could adequately prepare in 5 months. The judge speculated as much when he said that he would have to start all over and this would delay trial, and he just wasn't going to hear of it.
Well, counsel, would you have a different case if the private counsel had filed a motion to substitute in as counsel?
No, I wouldn't have a different case. I'd have a better chance of persuading you, but I wouldn't have a different case, and I'll tell you why. Because there is no rule of procedure that would allow that to happen. The only rule that allows under these circumstances would have been Rule 44. But Rule 44 explicitly says that withdrawal and entry of new counsel is up to the discretion of the court. And furthermore, just to file a substitution of counsel, for example, that requires the consent of the prosecutor. And the prosecution certainly wasn't consenting here.
But was my experience with some civil practice, but I'm certainly aware that people can file additional appearances. Mr. St. Veltri could have filed an appearance, and then there could have been a dispute about whether or not the other counsel had to withdraw. Is there anything that would prevent that?
That would have given me more ammunition to convince you that this is preserved, but it wouldn't make it any more preserved. If it is preserved, that would have been extra that I could bring to you and say, look, they even did this. I mean, in Gonzalez-Lopez, the attorney from out of state filed an entry that was stricken. We don't have that here.
What in the record is there that allows us to say, to understand that Mr. St. Veltri is ready and willing to appear?
Nothing. However, which way does that cut? The fact that we also don't have any evidence that the opposite. I mean, there is no record. The court, without a record, said he can't enter. I am disallowing you. He not only did that, the judge ordered Ms. Sparrows in that same September 22nd hearing, ordered her to pay the public defender back. She was going to get to hire counsel, all right, but it had to be the public defender. So we don't know that, but we do know this. We do know, and I've cited it in my briefs, that he appeared and represented her on her federal cases involving the same profession, her interior design business. He represented her in an additional state case. And we know from the record that that the day trial started, he did in fact enter his appearance in the case, in the other case. There were two of these cases going at the same time. So Mr. St. Veltri represented Ms. Sparrows on all of the cases she'd had previously and that are in the record, and we know that. And we know that he represented her on the, I think it was an 06 case, and that reference is in the record. We also know that she could afford him. The public defender said this on the record. This argument that she couldn't and that somehow that was that third issue I wasn't even sure warranted.
Well, I thought that the trial court pushed the public defender a little bit for proof that she could afford him and wasn't satisfied that the proof was there at that time. And weren't her assets being frozen in the other litigation or proceedings?
Yes, sir. You're referring now, I believe, to March 16th. The strongest point from Ms. Sparrows occurred on September 22nd, but on March 16th, they came again before the court, and the prosecutor said, well, if Mr. St. Veltri appeared by magic, that he hadn't appeared yet in the other case, the case that he did ultimately appear in. And the judge looked at defense counsel or the prosecutor, and you'll see in March 16th, the judge says, is that true? He hasn't entered his appearance in that other case yet? And she said no. Someone said no. And he said, well, I'm setting trial date. He didn't reconsider his ruling. He didn't reverse his ruling or anything of the sort. Now, we're accustomed to the situation, at least I was as a trial counsel, that there's a chicken and the egg thing that goes on. The new counsel say, gee, if you can go get me a continuance, I'll enter. Right? How many of us have tried to have been hired and we said, oh, I'm not going to do that, but if you give me a continuance, I'll enter my appearance. And the court says, well, if he enters his appearance, I'm not giving a continuance. So there are these things that happen. I don't think this is exactly one of them. All that judge had to do to pull the rug out was to say, as I said, do what you will, but this trial's proceeding. And the judge would have at least been giving her permission to do whatever she wanted. The day that this happened, the public defender was so sure that it wasn't going to happen. He, as you recall, I'm sure, he didn't even have his file with him. He was so sure, another indication of do we know if Mr. St. Veltri was going to appear. The public defender certainly thought it was going to happen. He came to that motion hearing believing it was going to happen, didn't even bring his file. When the judge said, no, he can't come in, go get your file, that's when they held the hearing.
What was the specific motion before the court on the 22nd? Wasn't it a motion for counsel to withdraw as opposed to a motion for new counsel to?
I believe there were a number of motions. I think that was the pretrial motions hearing date, and there were a number of motions.
But on this question, was there there was a motion to withdraw. Was there also a motion for, to allow Mr. St. Veltri to appear?
That was just oral, Your Honor. And I can't even confirm for sure for you that there was a written motion to withdraw, mea culpa. But I know that they were there for pretrial motions hearing. The public defender was quite sure that Mr. St. Veltri was going to enter. Everybody said he can enter, right? And the judge said, no, you're going to pay an attorney, but you're going to pay the public defender. And again, it was the judge's speculation that said, I'm not willing to start all over again on a complex case. The things that are quoted in Volume 3, Page 7, you'll see him saying all of his reasons. And my contention is those were an abuse of discretion, that those were predicting, those were speculating that Mr. St. Veltri couldn't be ready. They were putting the cart before the horse. And I think the issue that we're going around with is what was she to do at that point? Should she have, I'm sorry, I know there's a question there.
Go ahead, finish yours.
Should she have, even in spite of an order that you cannot hire your lawyer, I know you're not indigent, I know you can hire him, but you can't do this, should she have somehow proceeded anyway? Should St. Veltri, for example, have entered his appearance without a rule of evidence that provides for anything like that? In criminal cases, it's up to the, there's Rule 44. There's no provision for him just to sort of come in and enter his appearance, especially since the public defender and he were in very different firms and may have had some claims. I mean, there may be some claims against that the public defender that Mr. Veltri, you know, you just, I mean, again, we're getting into things the trial court should have gotten into.
Here's my question.
Yes, sir.
Was it as black and white as the trial court saying, I'm not going to let you spend money on your own private attorney, but you are going to spend money on reimbursing the public defender's office? Or was the trial court saying, I can't tell from the record whether she's indigent, and if she's not indigent, then she'll have to reimburse?
It was more like that, and it certainly wasn't in the same sentence. He said, and it's just in, it's a very short record, September 22nd. And in fact, that order to reimburse the public defender was brought up again at sentencing. And the sentencing judge, who was different than the pretrial hearing judge, did not enforce it. In fact, they appointed the counsel for the indigent defendant on appeal. But that order was a real live order. There was no claim in the trial court. This claim that she couldn't really afford him or that kind of thing, that was never a claim made. That's why there's no record. You say, where's the record she could afford it? Nobody raised that argument. Nobody said you can't do that. What the trial judge says is, I don't want to continue this case. And in the last paragraph of Gonzalez-Lopez, the U.S. Supreme Court addressed that issue. They said, we're not going to interfere with the court's ability to make scheduling and other decisions that effectively exclude defendant's counsel of choice. But that's not what the court did here. We don't know what would have happened, but we do know that she invoked a ruling, preserved the issue. The court said, no, you can't have your own attorney enter for these reasons, none of which had to do with indigency. And then do not have time to address the inadequate inquiry case, but I would only say all of the issues are important to us, and we carry forth all of those issues. And I would like to save my remaining moments for a rebuttal. But I think that the interesting thing on the counsel of choice issue is that, I mean, the inadequate inquiry issue, is that when the issue came up, and the court said, and she said, there's real problems with the defense. She had her attorney say it. And the trial court said, everything you say is going to be used against you. You know, do you want to talk? And she started to talk. And then he says to the public defender, you know, you might want to talk to your client, because anything she says, I'm going to use against her. And then he spoke to his client. And he said, she just wants to tell you she's operating in good faith here. And this is an absolute inadequate inquiry. There's controlling law. These proceedings must be in camera. They can't be on the record. They could be devastating to the defense on the record, especially a fraud case, to have to go into the deficiencies in this representation. So I did run out of time for that. I'd like to reserve what moments I have left for rebuttal.
You have 44 seconds.
Unless there's more questions now. Thank you.
May it please the court, Alice Hosley, registration number 32195, on behalf of the people. let's be clear about the September 22nd, 2005 hearing. It was not represented that any specific attorney was waiting in the wings to appear. What was represented at this first hearing for a motion to continue, a motion to withdraw on September 22nd, was that the defendant was talking to several attorneys, and one of them may choose to take the case. There was not an individual attorney named or represented that there was a specific named attorney prepared to come on for Ms. Spiros, regardless of her previous representation by him in previous cases, which I know nothing about, but I'm assuming have very different facts. This was a complex fraud theft case with multiple defendants, or excuse me, multiple witnesses and victims. It had been at the first request for a continuance and withdrawal, request continue in order to have a private attorney come on. The case was over a year old at that point. Discovery had been completed. This isn't a case where a new person can just jump in the middle, regardless of their knowledge and familiarity with the defendant and her previous cases. I think that part of what is important about the inquiry at the September 22nd.
Excuse me for interrupting, but
sure.
What if, and it's an if question, so okay. It's obviously asking for a little speculation, but if counsel had come forward, perhaps in response to an inquiry from the judge and said, yes, I can be ready by that time, or if she had said, if you can come up with, if the judge had told the defendant, if you can come up with a lawyer who says he or she will be ready for the trial and won't slow things down, that would be okay. Wouldn't that have been permissible? That wouldn't have
absolutely. This is an abuse of discretion case. There are multiple variables. There are multiple factors to consider. If there was an attorney that had actually appeared, a named attorney that had actually appeared and entered an appearance, appeared at the September 22nd hearing instead of hypothetical, I've been talking to some people and I may be able to find somebody to come on. Look, it was 5 months before trial. The case had already been going for a year. The judge did not abuse his discretion. He considered the timeliness of the motion with respect to the complexity of the case, the inconvenience to the victims, his own docket at that point. Once you start delaying one case, you necessarily push other cases. And there was no guarantee that there was somebody who was willing to enter or that could take this to trial within the scheduled time. I think counsel's proposal that the judge could have said, sure, bring another counsel on, but I'm not going to continue anything. That's just setting up for ineffective assistance claim later on. I mean, that's that doesn't get anybody anywhere. And I think because there were several motions to continue, motions to withdraw as this case progressed closer to trial. Keep in mind the defendant. Trial was scheduled for February of 2006. Defendant failed to appear. She was later brought back from California. And so at the March hearing, after she failed to appear for the first trial date, again it was brought up, oh, she's going to obtain her own counsel. The prosecutor said, look, we need a date for trial on the books. We can't keep continuing this. These delay tactics of the defendant aren't helping in consideration of the rest of this balance. The victims at this point were seeking closure. There was no good cause given. And I guess that's what this comes down to. This right of choice of counsel is really at the beginning, at the initial onset, was defendant given a fair opportunity to retain counsel? And I would say a year into the case, for this to come up for the first time, absolutely she was given ample time before discovery was complete, before the complex nature of the case started leaning towards the balance of not continuing the case for another extended period of time. Once that initial inquiry is done, then it's a question of, it's a totality of the circumstances. And, you know, that comes down to, is there good cause to justify a delay? In this case, the court said no. It weighed a bunch of factors, including the complexity of the case, the timeliness of the motion, and with respect to the date of trial, which I understand ended up not being the date of trial, but that was unforeseen at the time that this motion was denied. The fact that defense counsel, who was appointed, was prepared, given adequate representation to the defendant. There was no claim at the September 22nd hearing of any dissatisfaction with her attorney. There was no allegations of incompetence or breakdown of communications or irreconcilable differences. It was only the oral representation of the defendant that she was no longer indigent, and therefore she didn't qualify for the public defender, and she was going to retain her own counsel. I think your questions to opposing counsel were very pointed and direct in that you have to fill out paperwork to be appointed public defender, and the judge had nothing in front of him to show that this scenario had changed. He was concerned at this point about keeping his docket in line, and I think it is perfectly reasonable for him, in order to change that ruling that she qualified for public defender, it was perfectly reasonable for him to require some sort of documentation or something more than the oral representation of the defendant through her attorney that she was no longer indigent. I think this indigency issue became moot after her failure to appear since she was in custody from then through the actual trial date. But at the September 22nd, 2005 hearing, there was no other named attorney. The court did not say, no, you cannot have that attorney. The court said, no, I'm not going to continue in order to allow you to find somebody to take your case. And I think with all the factors in play at that point, which I've touched on both in my brief and here, that it was not an abuse of discretion for him to make that ruling. I'm happy to go into, yes.
You're happy to move on, is that what you
Yes.
Because I was going to say I'd like to shift gears.
Absolutely.
Very good. At one point, there's a dissatisfaction of appointment of counsel in this case, right?
Of Correct.
Of counsel. Did the trial court inquire into the reasons for the dissatisfaction?
Yes.
Can you tell me about that?
Absolutely. That was on the first day of trial. So it would have been August 30th then of the following year, 2006. And what was represented was that the defendant didn't feel as though defense counsel had prepared her for her potential testimony, and also that the defendant or the defense counsel did not have information about other witnesses that she had only told him about the week prior. The extent of that inquiry, the judge asked trial counsel, what's your feeling? Are you unprepared? Do you need a continuance? And the defense counsel's response was, in good conscience, I cannot ask for a continuance. Meaning he felt he was prepared. He had been on the case for 2 years at that point, almost 2 years, October 2004 until the trial in August of 2006. I think the inquiry really broke down as the judge conducted the inquiry. What it really came down to was that it was another delay tactic by the defendant, who was just trying to seek a further continuance. It was not a true dissatisfaction. The record reveals that other issues were coming up, what she was wearing, that she didn't feel comfortable going to trial. You know, these things, just the inquiry as it progressed, it became clear it was a delay tactic and not a true dissatisfaction with her trial counsel.
Did she discuss a conflict with her attorney at all, a conflict of interest or a breakdown in communications?
No, sir. It was only the closest she got to a legitimate legitimate case for having her attorney withdraw was that he was not prepared for witnesses that she had just told him the week prior. In this two-year pendency case, she had just told him the week before about witnesses that she said he was not then prepared to proceed with. And that leads to the point about the failure to inquire. With the four different motions to continue, motions to withdraw that were filed, the only one where an inquiry would have been required, because it was the only one where any dissatisfaction with her attorney was alleged, was the first day of trial. So this inquiry, the failure of the court to inquire, really did not become an issue until the first day of trial. And since we discussed the context of that inquiry, I won't go into that any further. So I'm happy to discuss the details of the other motions to continue, motions to withdraw at length, and explain why they were not an abuse of discretion. But I feel like that's very well covered in my brief. If you have any questions about that, I'm happy to answer them. Otherwise, I thank the court for your time.
Thank you.
Please, the court. There is a new case, and I didn't have it in a supplement. I don't think we've cited it, but counsel's brought up this issue about the first day of trial expressing dissatisfaction. There's a case that came out in January from the Colorado Supreme Court, People versus Bergerud, where they remanded for an evidentiary hearing, even though his concerns were first day of trial. It's more appropriate for a supplement so they can respond, but there is a response to that, and it is People versus Bergerud out of the Supreme Court, January 10th, I believe. Counsel says that what the court said is you can't have this attorney. She writes a new rule saying when counsel have to enter appearance, how they do it, you have to specify counsel. But the error in this case is that the trial court said you can't have any attorney. And once that ruling's made, the issue's preserved.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Ms. Hosley, if you want to prepare a written response to her citation of the Berger case. Okay. Very good. We're familiar with the Berger case, and one of our jobs is to read Supreme Court cases. So that concludes our, I want to thank you both for your arguments. The case will stand submitted, and written opinion will issue in due course. This concludes oral argument for today. The court will be in recess.